You. She gives his hand a squeeze. He seethes.
I can't leave here. This is my home.
We have a new home now.
You don't get to just kidnap me and...
I can, because I am your mother. A thousand angry rebuttals run through his head, like ring dogs chasing their own banded tails. But now isn't the time.
I have a plan,
he says. It's not a lie. Not really.
I'm listening.
Stay here. Follow my signal.
She starts to protest, but he darts out from behind the crates. Timon hurries up to the cabin door. Next to it, on the wall, a panel. He casts a look to his mother, who gives him a quizzical stare.
I'm sorry,
are the two words he mouths to her silently. Her eyes go wide as she figures it out.
I have a plan. It's just not one you're gonna like.
He quickly punches a few buttons on the wall panel. He overrides the cargo bay's pneumatic hinges, the ones that would open the bay door and ramp slowly, settling it against the ground as gently as a mother resting her baby in the cradle. Timon doesn't have time for that. He pops the pistons with a screaming hiss, and the bay ramp drops with a resounding gong. Outside, a cracked, shattered landing pad. Roots and shoots pushing up through the plastocrete. Jungle and city beyond. And stormtroopers. A whole squad of stormtroopers. They seem taken by surprise. They aren't lined up, ready for battle. They're out there milling around, standing about, poking through the underbrush and cracking open crates. That gives Timon one shot. He yells, running forward, slamming his shoulder into the pallet full of crates. With a quick shove of his knee, he jams the button on the pallet handle, and the thing suddenly pops up off the ground, hovering a few centimeters above the bay floor. His mother rushes for him, but she's too slow. Timon hurries forward, pushing the hovering crate stack out the bay door with his shoulder. He hides behind it, shielding himself from the sudden fusillade of blaster fire. His mother calls after him, but all he can think is,
"This was a stupid, stupid idea!"
"Do we have a problem?"
Surat Nuat asks. Sinjir crossed the gambling floor, shoving past dice throwers and card holders until he was standing in front of the Sullustan gangster. And now that gangster stands there, regarding him with one good eye. Sinjir feels suddenly dissected, like a winged insect pulled apart by a cruel child's plucking fingers. The feeling is only made more intense by the clatter of blasters raised in his direction and ready to fire. Gasps all around. The music stops. Eyes watch. He feels his new Twi'lek friend trembling behind him. Sinjir clears his throat and smiles.
"Not at all," Sinjir says. "No problems here. A polite entreaty, if you will. May I appeal to your..."
What word will satisfy this self-important thug? What will tickle the Sullustan's ego? An ego sure to be as plump and bloated as a sun-cooked shock carcass.
"To your limitless grace, your many-faced wisdom, your eternal might?"
Surat smacks his lips together.
"You have an eloquence. Manners. I like that. Even if your crooked human nose is dark with excrement. So, make your plea, but make it quickly."
The thought runs laps in Sinjir's mind.
"Just walk away. This does not involve you. She's no one. She does not matter. You don't know each other. You had a moment, one singular moment. Moments do not tally to anything meaningful. Run away, like you are so good at doing."
But that woman, the Zabrak, is watching him. And he might be imagining it, but is that recognition in her eyes? A familiar scrutiny? As if to confirm it, she gives him a small nod of her head. To Surat, Sinjir says,
"The woman, is she yours to sell?"
"She is,"
Surat confirms, pursing his lips in amusement.
Then I would buy her. I would pay well for a first chance.
The process,
Surratt interrupts.
For a prime candidate such as this would be an auction to maximize the effort and to ensure that all interested buyers have a chance.
I will then offer to pay extra to undercut them.
Surratt holds up a hand.
It does not matter, because there shall be no auction for this one. We already have a buyer lined up. Unless you think you can equal the endless coffers of the Galactic Empire.
Sinjir's heart sinks in his chest, like a stone in swamp mud. But he refuses to show the fear and disappointment on his face. Instead, he clasps his hands and smiles big.
Then there must be some confusion, a muddled communication. You see, I am from the Galactic Empire, an emissary. I am a loyalty officer, Sinjir Rath Velis, last stationed at the Imperial Shield base on Endor, and now here on Akiva, as part of a diplomatic mission. Did they not tell you I was coming? We used to have it so together before those rebel pigs blew up our favorite toy. I apologize, but I'm here now at...
I have not yet informed the Empire of this prize,
Surratt says.
What? I don't follow.
They do not know I have this one.
The gangster gestures toward the woman.
Perhaps you have a Jedi around somewhere who predicted my call? Or maybe you, loyalty officer Sinjir Rath Velis, or some kind of wizard in possession of great precognition?
Well, I am quite gifted.
Or maybe you are a rebel, or just a con artist. Does it even matter?
Sinjir swallows hard. He forces a smile and says,
I assure you, I...
Surratt scowls.
Kill him!
The gangster barks. Surratt's men start firing.
We have a problem, Admiral,
Adia Wright says. Sloane marches down the palace hall, the walls lined with gold-framed portraits of Satrap's past, the sluggy, jowly face of Satrap Mongo Hingo, the jaundiced, sickly countenance of Satrap Tin Withrafisp, the handsome, smoldering portrait of young Satrap Kate Hingo, a young lad governor who died too early. Written history says, by assassin, but whispered history says, by venereal disease. Sloane skids to a halt and says,
What kind of a problem? I'll remind you that I am heading to a meeting that will make or break the back of the Empire and the galaxy it endeavors to rule.
Oh, the look of fear that rises on the poor girl's face, like a sun darkened by clouds. Sloane feels a small pinprick of shame over that. Whatever the problem is, it's not likely to be the girl's fault. Still, to her credit, she summons her courage after drawing a breath.
Two rebel scout ships,
Adia says. Again, to her credit, she says this quietly. Who knows if anyone would be listening?
Where? Here? Above this planet?
A small nod.
Yes. Tothwyn claims both were rebel-designated A-wings. This is happening too soon.
And what became of them?
Not that it matters much.
Adia says,
Both were destroyed before they could return to hyperspace.
Ray winces.
Did the other star destroyers see?
I don't think so. At least they haven't indicated such. The ships came in on the starboard side, away from the other two destroyers. The distance between the destroyers suggests they couldn't have.
That may buy them a bit more time. If the A-wings were able to return successfully and make a report, the swiftness of a rebel attack on their burgeoning blockade could be profound. But since the A-wings can't return, the rebels won't have any useful intel. It will give them pause. The A-wings could be dead from an Imperial attack, yes, or a volatile Oort cloud, or an unexpected debris field. The rebel fleet will exercise caution.
Regardless, that leaves her with a new problem. Does she tell the others? She could attempt to supersede their authority. Neither Shale nor Pandion is an admiral. Neither technically possesses the authority to command fleet movements like Sloane does. But each is still in command of a Star Destroyer. And the rules these days are not so clear on who truly has proper authority to do anything at all. If she tries to run an endgame around them, they will try to run one around her as well. A coup, perhaps. Then the meeting will become a different game altogether. She bites back a curse. Right, she says, then thanks the assistant. Sloane marches toward the first fateful meeting of the summit.
What's the problem in... Hey!
Nora wheels toward the voice and sees that it belongs to a stormtrooper, one of three standing there at the door between the bay and the bulk of the ship. The three step in, blaster rifles up and ready. Timon, why did you have to run? A smaller voice inside her answers. Because you gave him no choice. Outside the ship, past the bay door where she can't see, Nora hears the sounds of battle.
Blast them!
Blaster rifles! Men yelling in alarm!
What's going on? There!
One of the stormtroopers says, spotting her. The three turn toward her, pointing and gesturing with their weapons.
Freeze!
The third says,
stand up!
Slowly, Nora stands. The blaster at her hip feels heavy, as if burdened with great purpose and great risk. Her hand itches to reach down, pull it out, take her chances. Her blood roars in her ears, a river of fear and anger. It rushes back to her, them kicking down her family's door, the Imperials dragging her husband out of her son's bedroom, the stormtrooper slamming her in the head with the end of his rifle. She thinks, you're fast. The bucketheads are slow. Take the shot. One of the troopers turns back toward the bay. He startles, taken by surprise, and for a moment she doesn't know why.
Look out!
He starts to say, and then blaster fire pins him to the wall. The other two pivot, blasters up and firing, but it's too late for them too. A speeder bike bolts in through the bay doors and drifts as it enters, its back end sliding hard and clipping the two stormtroopers in the knees. They cry out as the speeder wipes them out, knocking them to the floor. Timon lifts the brim of his new helmet with his thumb.
Let's go, he says. Go, 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 go!
Nora takes a deep breath and hops on the back of the speeder as Timon twists his grip forward. The vehicle takes off like a proton rocket.
We have a...
Ray starts to say. Pandion answers.
A problem. Yes, I should say so. I have heard that Captain Antilles is not yet responding to any of our... efforts.
Tashu, having arrived late, wearing a strange red metal mask, one that appeared quite demonic, spins the mask, now face down on the table with his hand.
Do not worry, Moff Pandion. My technique takes time, but I have been trained by the best. The ancient Sith art of...
It's grand, Moff, Pandion says. And I may remind you here that the Sith are all dead, and you carry none of their magic with you.
The problem,
Rey says, putting some fire in her voice,
is that the Vigilance encountered two Rebel A-Wing scouts. We dispatched both, but...
Arson Crassus stands up. The man, already white as ground-down bone powder, goes almost translucent. Panic coils around his voice, tightening as he stammers,
The Rebels will come for us! We must end this meeting immediately, as I am no warrior, but merely a merchant!
Sit down,
Ray says. Crassus hesitates, rubbing thumbs against fingers, a nervous habit. Pandion says,
Don't be a coward, Crassus. Sit.
Crassus sits then, though Sloane notes only when Pandion says to.
I have a plan, she says, though it may seem unconventional.
Jilia Shale leans forward.
We're listening.
I want to move the Star Destroyers to hyperspace. Not far, but out of both optic and far-sweep sensor range.
That will leave us exposed,
Crassus says. If the Rebels find nothing here, they'll move along. They don't have the time or the resources to monitor some backwater fringe territory such as this. But if they see a trio of Imperial Star Destroyers...
Pandion leans back in his chair, sneering.
Apparently I'm at a table full of cowards. Let me posit an alternative solution, Admiral. You are in control of the Ravager fleet, our last super Star Destroyer. And you have it and, well, how many ships? We don't even know. An unknown quantity hidden away, the way a greedy child hides his best toys.
Here he leans forward, pointing an accusing finger.
Perhaps it's time to share, Admiral. Bring your fleet forward. Let's not run with our tail tucked betwixt our legs. Let's go the other way. Build up our presence. The Rebels come poking around, they'll find they have stirred a nest of vipers.
No!
General Shale says, giving the table a pound with her small, wrinkled fist. The old woman gives a firm shake to her head.
None of us is ready for that. This is a game of Chaturagul. All the tokens are on the board, whether we like it or not. Minions, scouts, knights, all the way to the Pontiffs, the Alcazar, the Empress. You never move the Empress out unless you have no other choice. That was our failing with Palpatine's grand battle station. The Death Star was our Empress. We moved it forward too quickly. A Chaturagul gambit that failed spectacularly.
Speak plainly,
Pandion says.
This isn't a game.
It is a game,
Jillia says, her jaw set.
It is a game with very high stakes, where we must second-guess our opponent. The head of the New Republic fleet is Grand Admiral Akbar. He is a genius tactician, a warrior of the mind. But he will not be quick to jump into this. One Rebel missing, then two more on top. He will fear something is going on, that this could be yet another trap for him to blunder into. But without any information at all, he will be hesitant to send one more Rebel to the grave. His next play will most likely be to send a drone ship.
Or a droid, Ray says.
Yes, yes, a long-range probe. That is likely. Sent from a ship kept at a distance close enough for scanner range, which means if we have ships here, that droid will be wholly unnecessary, and that ship will be out of range of our weapons. It will jump to hyperspace, and Akbar will mobilize his fleet. And then it is open war once more. A battle that we cannot afford to lose, because, as I will remind you, we are expending resources at a greater rate than we produce them. We've lost ships, weapons factories, droid factories, spice mines, fuel depots. You want to risk more of it? We cannot afford to pay that debt.
Cowards!
Pandion rages, standing up so fast his chair almost knocks over behind him.
The Ravager is a powerful weapon. And Sloane is sitting on it like a fat Nuna hen upon a nest of already hatched eggs.
He points to Crassus and Tashu.
This is a meeting where every voice counts, does it not? Then let me ask you two. How do you vote? Are we an empire of curs and cuckoo hens, clucking and whimpering in the dark? What say you?
Crass gives a nod.
I say we bring that super Star Destroyer forward. I say we attack.
He awkwardly thrusts a fist into the meat of his open hand. Ray says,
Crassus has already admitted that he is no warrior. Just a merchant, wasn't it, Arson? You're going to take his advice.
Tashu speaks, jumping ahead of Pandion's next outburst.
I will say this. The Sith are masters of deception. It is no cowardice to hide in the shadows and strike when your enemy passes. I agree with the Admiral.
Sloane nods.
That's 3-2. We move the destroyers.
No,
Pandion says.
One of those ships is under my command, and I won't move it. It stays.
The defiance in his eyes flashes like starfire. This is happening earlier than Sloane expected. She always knew one of them, probably Valco Pandion, would test her. Fine. She marches around the side of the table and meets him nose to nose.
I am the admiral of this naval fleet. You do not have the authority, self-proclaimed or not, to command one ship against the movement of its fellows. You do not have the authority to deny me in this.
Pandion grins.
And what if I do anyway?
Then the Vigilance will shoot your ship out of the sky. Its pieces will rain down upon us, and that is how the Empire will end. With us destroying one another like rats driven mad by hunger. Rats who eat one another instead of hunting down a proper meal.
I could take my ship, flee to some distant system.
Flee? She asks. You want to run? So you're the coward.
From Pandion, a small intake of breath, a tiny little gasp.
I have you.
For now.
Admiral,
he says, his tone suddenly changing. He even offers a wan smile and bows his head.
I am, of course, just playing the Imperial Advocate. One must attempt to fully dissect the animal to understand it. And so I appreciate you letting me challenge you in this way. Do as you see fit.
She nods. A temporary victory, she thinks. But Pandion is doing exactly what she wants to do with the fleet above Akiva. He's retreating temporarily, in the hope of fighting again another day. What was it Tashu said? Hide in the shadows and strike when your enemy passes.
Seems we do have a problem after all,
Sinjir thinks, ducking blaster fire and leaping up, running across gambling tables. He kicks a set of chits up into the air. The gambler, some degenerate nerf herder with a sweat-slick face, chases after his lost chits and gets blaster fire in the back for his trouble. Sinjir knocks a set of dice off another table, then nearly trips on a gambling wheel before taking a running leap.
He catches the bar top across his middle. The air goes out of his lungs.
Blaster fire peppers the wood and sends bottles and glasses spinning to the ground, shattering.
Sinjir oofs, but still clambers up and over,
holding his arms above his head to protect his skull from the falling barware. Then, everything goes quiet. He thinks, is it over? A shadow descends over him. The bartender looks down, greasy grin on his face, his chin still green and slimy with leaf spit.
You got a problem,
the bartender says. Then the bartender drops a fist like a falling meteor. It hits Sinjir like a malfunctioning bay door piston, and his eyes roll back in his head as everything goes slippery, and he tumbles toward unconsciousness.
Interlude. Uter.
We have a problem,
the driver says. Young Pade sees the smoke over the hills long before he sees what's making it, though the boy can certainly take a guess. He looks around at the other recruits, or potential recruits anyway. They're all whispering about it now, murmuring and opening the windows on the transport and looking out. The hoverbus driver, a bewhiskered, round-muzzled Nimbinel, looks back with eyes that look beady under its huge brow. The Nimbinel says to Pade and the other boys,
You tell them I don't work for the Empire. I'm just a driver. You all know that, right?
Go on, mister, Pate says. Just turn around and get us there.
The Nimbinel mutters something mean under his breath. One of the other boys, a pudge-bellied kid with dark, coarse hair and a speckling of moles on his cheek, turns around and stares over the seat at Pate.
You think we're done for?
I don't know,
Pate says with a shrug.
Wait and see, I figure.
He puts on a tough face. It's a lie, though, because he's scared, too. The bus continues on, riding over the broken roads of Uter, hills rising up on either side. The grass, once green, now bleached pale. And soon, tucked between those hills, the Imperial Stormtrooper Academy here. It's burning. Or rather, it has burned. Half of it is torn open by the tearing hands of old fire, and now black smoke drifts from inside it. On the ground, a dozen dead stormtroopers. Among them, other men and women. Not Imperials, simple vests and utility belts. They have rifles and blasters. All the boys on the bus lean out and stare. They, like Pade, have never seen weapons up close. Pitchforks and spanners, and a few blunt instruments here and there. Mostly they're farm boys, locals from the fringes. Some of them recruited by officers. Some of them, like Pade, were simply sent away. Sent here, to a place that is no longer a place. The bus stops as one of the men, one of the rebels, Pade thinks, steps in front of the vehicle. The door opens, and the Nimbinel steps out. The boys stay seated, not sure what they should do. Pade thinks to look tough. He gets off the bus. The Nimbinel and the rebel, a man with a scruffy beard and a scar running across the side of his neck, are arguing. The Nimbinel is waving his hands, saying,
"No, no, these kids are not my responsibility! No, I won't drive them back! I'm not paid for that!"
"Sir," the rebel says, "as you can see, the Imperial Academy is closed. This isn't a place for kids anymore."
And then he sees Pade standing there. The man turns away from the driver and looks down.
"Mister,"
Pade says.
"Son," the man says. "We'll get you back on the bus and on your way home in two twitches of an earth tail."
"I don't want to go home."
"Just the same, home isn't here."
"Home isn't anywhere, then. My parents kicked my can down the road and moved on when I wasn't looking. Went off to be nomads somewhere. It's the Imperial Academy for me, or it's nowhere."
The rebel chews on that. He looks off at the hills. Then to the Nimbinel, and the bus, and back to Pade.
"What'll you do if you can't go here?"
"I told you, go nowhere."
Pade leans, lowers his voice.
"You kill the kids in that academy? Ones who are gonna be baby stormtroopers?"
"What? Stars, no."
"What did you do with them?"
"You sure stick your nose in it, don't you, kid?"
"Maybe that's why my parents fixed to get rid of me."
The man sighs. He kneels down.
"Some of those kids will go home. Some of them are heading out to the new academy on Chandrilla. If they're of an age, we'll take them and teach them how to be soldiers, if they care to join the cause. Otherwise, it's back to their parents, or to orphanages."
Pade thrusts out his chin.
"And that's where I want to go to. The new academy."
"Hmm." The man narrows his eyes. "All right. Here."
He dives in his pockets, pulls out a handful of credits, then turns and slaps them into the Nimbinel's palm. To Pade, he says,
"Central City's still in the Empire's back pocket, so make sure he drives you to Riverbreaker. Shuttle's leaving there tomorrow morning for Hanna City. Be on it."
Pade nods.
"Thanks, mister."
"Other boys are welcome to catch that ride, too. You tell them."
"I will."
Pade turns, then calls over his shoulder.
"Thanks. May the Force be with you, mister."
"You too, kid. You too."
Chapter 13.
A strange thing, being a parent. A parent raises a child with the expectation that it's her job to teach the child how to, well, how to do everything. How to eat, live, breathe, work, play, exist. A mother advises her child on how to deal with bullies at the academy, or what streets are safe and what ones aren't, or how to drive a bala-bala cart without crashing it into a wall. The parent teaches these things because the child needs to know. Because the child isn't capable. Not the child's fault, of course. They're born a clean slate. It's the parent's job to put the first writing on the wall. To make sure that writing serves as an instruction manual. To ensure, well, the kid doesn't die trying to figure out how to live. It's hard to get out of that mode. Hard to see when one's child has cast off the mantle of ignorance and figured out how to do things. Or just how to be. And right now, Nora isn't seeing it. Because her son is about to kill them both. She leaps on the speeder bike, and Temin launches back out of the moth's bay doors like a Yogan bat with its wings on fire. She tugs on his arm, points toward the jungle. The rainforest is thick, and it's easy to get lost out there. These stormtroopers aren't wilderness ready. They're not proper speeder pilots. Out among the trees and vines, Temin and Nora will be able to disappear. Maybe even down into the canyon. But Temin doesn't listen. Listening, it seems, is no longer his strong suit. He used to be a good listener. A good kid. Always headstrong, sure. But he listened to his mother, took her advice, did what she told him to do. That has changed. Plainly. She tells him to go toward the jungle, and he goes the other way. Temin points the speeder back toward the city. The streets are too narrow. They can take some of the main thoroughfares, yes, whip the speeder down the CBD or across Main 66. But the former will be choked with people, and the latter choked with vehicles and herd animals. She tries to yell at him again, trying to get him to turn back around and head toward the rainforest. But he brushes her off, just as laser fire kicks up mud and stone around them. A glance over her shoulder reveals two speeder bikes coming up fast. The stormtroopers are hunched forward, throttling the speeders to their maximum. Red blaster fire sears the air from underneath the bladed steering vanes at the fore of each vehicle. She yells in Temin's ear, "Incoming!" And he gives her a quick nod, and then cuts the speeder sharply to the right. He takes it over a small berm, and then beneath them is the shattered plasticrete that takes them right down a winding alley. Walls whip past on each side. Nora finds her breath trapped in her lungs. Just a few centimeters one way or another, and they're toast. If she moves even a little bit, the wall will wear down her kneecap or elbow like a macro sander, and that'll be the end of them. Suddenly, the speeder jerks up and over a bundle of wire fencing crossing the alley. Behind them, both the pursuing speeders manage the same jump. One after the other, now in a line, not next to each other. Which means that only one can fire its cannon. A shrewd move by her son. Maybe. As long as they don't die from taking a too sharp turn. Temin does indeed take a sharp turn. Around the bend of an octagonal building. An old bank, she thinks. Which means they're headed toward the markets. Toward the CBD Avenue. There, a wider place to drive, but more dangerous too. All those people will complicate the equation. Like asteroids floating in wide open space. And the last thing she wants to see is what happens when they clip some poor ship merchant or quilka leaf vendor and turn him into a red spray. Ahead, between a stack of boxes, the way toward the CBD. Blaster fire pocks the boxes. They jump and judder. The turn comes, and Temin doesn't take it. He keeps going straight. Ahead, a low wall. A dead end. Just a pile of junk. More bundles of wire, more crates, a piece of corrugated aluminum. She begins yelling Temin's name. Temin! Temin! But he just gives her a thumbs up. He yells back, "Trust me!" Trust in her son. Trust him to make the right decisions. Trust him not to kill him, her, and those two stormtroopers hot on their tail. The wall approaches fast. Boxes, wire, sheet metal. It's then she realizes he's not going to go straight forward. He's going to take them straight up. One quick shot from the blaster at the four of his speeder, and the aluminum does a quick hop. It slides a bit to the left, creating a shallow ramp. He turns the speeder just so, and next thing Nora knows, her stomach is left somewhere about 3 meters behind them, down on the ground. Nora feels her son tense up, and then turbo thrusters push them forward, fast and hard. The speeder zips up the ramp, over the boxes, and along the top of the short wall. A wall that's scalloped, the concrete shaped with wavy contours, and the speeder follows them like a boat skipping across rollicking tides. They zip fast with sickening dips, and Nora holds on for dear life. Behind them, one of the stormtroopers tries the same move. The front foil catches at the lip of the wall, and the back end of the vehicle flips up and over. The stormtrooper shrieks as he pitches forward, the whole speeder crashing down on him. It bursts into a plume of flame. The other speeder makes the jump. Through the belching fire of the first speeder, it roars, cannon on full auto, peppering the air around them with screaming laser blasts. Tevin cuts to the right. He takes the speeder over a plank sitting catty-corner from the short wall to a taller one, a house with a decrepit rooftop garden long gone unused. They whip past a saggy-bellied, shaggy-chinned Lutrillian sitting in a half-collapsed lawn chair, a half-eaten amphibian in his grip. He barely startles as they zoom past. Temin, she realizes, isn't planning on dropping them down to street level at all. The rooftops. Of course. You want to travel Mira, most people stick to the streets. But Temin and his friends always used the rooftops, making jumps from building to building that would cause Nora to snap her ankle like a piece of brittle driftwood. Temin and the others set up planks and sheets of tin, ropes and balance poles, too. He knows the rooftops of this city well. And it occurs to her, this probably isn't the first time he's taken a speeder bike up here either. Her son, she realizes, is a damn good pilot. And a smaller voice chides her. Just as reckless as you, too. Suddenly, a shower of sparks behind them. Her tailbone vibrates as a blaster hit clips the back end of their own speeder. The vehicle starts to wobble and drift just as they cross over another set of planks to an even higher rooftop. But Temin manages to keep it steady. He reaches back, grabs his mother's hands, and pulls her forward, placing both her hands on the handlebar controls. Your turn! He yells, then starts to squirm under her arm. What? She yells back in panic. Ahead, a metal pole thrust up out of a greenhouse at a 45-degree angle. As Temin snakes his way to the back of the speeder, leaving her in control of it, he yells, Meet me at Aunt Esmel's! Temin, no! He jumps off the speeder. She continues to rocket forward. Ahead, a cobbled-together crossing of hull metal between one roof and another. Nora thinks to jam on the brakes, but doing that now, she'd lose too much momentum. Probably drop the front end of the speeder over the edge of the wall and go over with it. And so she does what she can. She accelerates. Behind her, she sees her son spin around the metal bar like a circus performer. When did he learn to do that? She wonders. And then he swings back down, landing right behind the stormtrooper on the Imperial speeder. Nora takes her own jump, crests another roof, and then brakes. The speeder protests the fast deceleration. She cocks the maneuvering controls so that she skids to a halt, parallel to the roof's edge. Her heart sinks when she sees, there on the roof, a stormtrooper, supine and still, and going the other direction. Temin's new ride disappearing back down the way they came. Nora grits her teeth, pivots the vehicle back around. But she hasn't ridden a speeder in years. Everything feels clumsy, and even as she throttles it forward again, the realization hits her like a fist to the chin. I've lost him.
Chapter 14. Thunder throttles the skies over Mira, lightning flicking between bands of dark clouds like a dewback's tongue. Darkness has settled in, and with it, the rains have come. Nora stares out the window. Rain streaks the circular glass. Every boom and flash makes Nora flinch.
I'm sure he's fine,
says her sister, Esmel. Esmel is older than she is by a good number of years. When Nora was born, Esmel was already running around the city with a gang of hooligans all her own. She's lost a lot of that rebellious edge since then. Now a woman content to sit in her home on Orchard Hill, as if waiting to die and join the rest of the graves that wait just up the road. Graves underneath fruiting trees, so that we may eat of those we lost and remember them, a plaque says on the gate into the orchard. That idea always turned Nora's stomach. Nora turns to meet Esmel. She's been trying to keep the anger inside the bottle, all stoppered up. But she's nervous, on edge, and she feels the bottle shaking, the glass cracking.
Really? Why would you say that?
Esmel, a wispy thing, just smiles.
He's always been fine.
Yes, fine. Perfectly, utterly fine. Like how he doesn't live here with you. But how you let him live in our old house. And how you let him turn it into his own personal little black market. Where he gets threatened by criminals. Where he steals and sells the stars know what. Where...
Esmel, always the smiler, pats Nora on the shoulder.
Nora, honey, you should be proud of him. You raised him to be smart, independent. You can't be mad at him for being what you taught him to be.
Nora laughs, a hollow, bitter sound.
I'm not mad at him, Esme. I'm ticked at you. I left him in your care. You were supposed to be a parent to my son. And now I find you've given that up? Did you ever even try? Did I?
The smile falls away from Esmel's face like the last leaf on a storm-shook tree. Her eyes narrow.
Good, Nora thinks. Let's do this. Let's scrap this out.
Might I remind you that you, dear Nora, took off? I thought better than to chase some fool's crusade halfway across the galaxy like you. Choosing to make other people your responsibility and not your own blood-born son. And...
Here, Esmel makes an exasperated sound.
And if you wonder why the boy enjoys hanging around criminals, might I remind you that your own husband was...
Nora raises the back of her hand.
Don't.
Esmel blinks, swallows, as if she realizes she danced right up to the edge of the cliff, and now it's breaking apart underneath her feet.
I'm simply saying... The boy's last memory of his father is of them coming and dragging him out into the streets like a common thief runner.
Brenton was a good man. He carried messages for the rebellion even before there was a rebellion. And now there's more than that. There's a new dawn, a new day, a new republic. In part because of people like him.
Esmel sniffs.
Yes, and I suppose you think you're just such a hero as well. You saved the galaxy, but lost your son. Worth it, dear sister?
Why, you venomous canyon adder!
Esmel's wife, Shireen, steps in. She secures Esmel's elbow with her own, giving the woman a kiss on the cheek.
Esme, how about a hot tea? I've left the thermojug on the stovetop in the kitchen.
Yes. Yes, that sounds good. I'll get tea.
Esmel offers a stiff smile, then fritters off as she is wont to do. Shireen sighs. Shireen is the opposite of Esmel in many ways. Esmel is thin, reedy, pale as a ghost. Shireen is rounded, pillowy, skin as dark as a handful of overturned soil. Her hair is short and curly and close to the scalp. Esmel's is long, a silver cascade down her back.
Shireen, you don't need to step into the middle of this.
Shireen clucks her tongue.
Please, Nora,
I'm in this. I have skin in this game. I love Temnin like my own son. But what I need you to realize is that he isn't our son.
Nora starts to protest, but Shireen shushes her. And somehow, Shireen has the magical ability to make that shushing feel gentle and welcome, soft and necessary.
Don't misunderstand me. I just mean that we were never ready for this. For him. He's got your spark in him. Yours and Brenton's. He's challenging because he's smart as a whipsnake, savvy as a sailbird. Forgive Esmail. Forgive me. We just weren't ready. And you were gone. So what choice did we have?
I had to go. I had to fight.
I know. And I'm sorry you never found Brent.
Nora winces at that. It's like being slapped. Shireen doesn't mean it that way. The look on her face tells Nora that the thought is a sincere one, and not a barbed lash. But it stings just the same.
He wasn't a criminal.
I know. And Esmail knows it too.
Outside, the sky splits with a close clap of thunder. Rain batters the side of the house. Normal for this time of year. The Mousin storms have already come and gone and ushered in the wet season.
Here's the Star's own truth, Shireen says. Temmin takes care of us more than we take care of him. He helps pay for things. Shows up at the start of the week with a basket of fruits and bread. Sometimes some work jerky or some of that spicy Arguez sausage. If our evaporator or flood pump breaks, he shows up with the parts and the tools and he fixes it. We're a couple of old cluckers, and he takes care of us good. We'll miss him.
You can come with us. That offer is still on the table.
Psst, Nora. Better or worse, we put down roots. We're as grown into this hill as the orchard up the road, as settled as the bones in the dirt. You take your boy, though, and get him somewhere better.
Nora sighs. It's not like he wants to go.
Well, he's built up a life here. That shop of his.
That shop of his?
It hits Nora like a beam of light.
That's where he went,
she says, scowling.
Temmin was never planning to come here. He went back to his shop. I never should have taken him away from there in the first place.
Well, that's probably all right.
It's not all right. Those criminals I mentioned, they'll be looking for him. Damn it! I'm too caught up in everything. I didn't even see it. Stormtroopers didn't get him. He just bailed.
She sighs, presses the heels of her hands into her eyes. Hard enough that she sees stars streaking and melting across the black behind her lids.
Ugh, I need to borrow your Bala Bala.
Shireen offers a sad smile.
Of course, Nora. Anything you need.
Damn this rain,
Temmin thinks. He lies on his belly on the rooftop of Master Hyorka's Dauben-steamed bun shop that sits across the alley from his own. And though he sits under a tarp, he's still soaked through like a red-eyed silt rat that drowned in a cistern. The rain pins him there like a divine hand. He again lifts the macro binoculars to his eyes, flicks them over to night vision. Two of Sarat Nuat's lackeys, a pot-bellied Rodian and an oil-skinned Herglick, continue to do what they've been doing for the last hour. They pitch junk from Temmin's shop into the street with a clang, clatter, and splash. And then the same pair of Kowakian monkey lizards descend from the nearby rooftop and canopy to pick through the shiniest bits before fleeing once more, cackling like tiny wizened lunatics. Inside, he hears more banging, drilling, yelling. They're trying to find out how to get into the sublayer. They want what he stole from Sarat. Not that he knows what exactly it is that he stole from Sarat. A weapon, he figures. Has to be. And whatever it is, it's his now. Not that Sulliston Fraghead's. When they have the door open, He can see just inside. And there, he sees the familiar pointed feet of his own personal B-1 battle droid bodyguard, Mr. Bones. The feet are still. They look collapsed against the legs, which means the rickety droid is collapsed and in storage mode. Worse, Timon can see a slight blue glow around the metal. That, he suspects, is the glow from an ion lock. It explains why Mr. Bones hasn't been responding to his comlink. He got the droid locked up and shut down in an ion field. Smart move. And it leaves Timon with one less option than before. In fact, Bones was his best chance to reclaim the shop quickly, if temporarily. Send the refurbed modded B-1 droid in to whip everybody's tail so that Timon could sneak in and get back into the sublayer to secure his stuff. With that option off the table, it means the longer, more arduous path awaits. He has to go find one of the bolt holes into the old catacombs beneath the city, then wend his way back to his own shop. He knows the way, but it won't be fast. Better to get to it then. And hope he gets there before Surratt's entourage of space brains figure out how to gain entry. Timon starts to put his binocs away. But then, off to his right, a shrill cackle. He knows that sound. Suddenly a flash of movement. A darting shape moves toward him, and one of the monkey lizards has seized his binocs. The little demon hisses and spits at him, then pecks at his hands when he starts playing tug-of-war with it. Get off! He growls. But then something cannonballs into the small of his back. The second monkey lizard. That one begins clawing at his ears and biting tufts of hair off his scalp, laughing all the while. It's enough of a distraction. The binocs slip from his grip, and the monkey lizard gambols about, delighting in its prize. Timon lurches to his feet, lunging for it, and the second one drops to the ground and darts in front of him. His ankle catches on the creature's body, its tail around his thigh, giving a hard tug. Next thing he knows, Timon is going tail over tea kettle as he tumbles over the edge of the roof. He hits the awning over the Dowben shop and rolls off it, landing in a deep puddle. He splutters and spits, lifting himself up, water streaming down in a small, dirty waterfall, his hair now in his eyes. Timon wipes locks away, and the curled tip of a giant axe blade hooks just inside his nostril and tugs his head up. Ow, ow, ow! The Herglick stands there, its mouth twisted into a sinister grin. Rows and rows of serrated teeth sliding together with the sound of a rasp running across wood. The Herglick cries,
It's the king! We got a kid!
Above the monkey lizards chant and cackle. He staggers through the forest, the burning forest, bits of brush smoldering, a stormtrooper helmet nearby, charred and half melted. A small fire burns nearby. In the distance, the skeleton of an AT-AT walker, its top blown open in the blast, peeled open like a metal flower. That burns, too. Bodies all around. Some of them are faceless, nameless. To him, at least. But others, he knows. Or knew. There, the fresh-faced officer. Kirk Lorman. Good kid. Eager to please. Join the Empire because it's what you did. Not a true believer. Not by any long stretch. Not far from him, Captain Blevins. Definitely a true believer. A froth-mouthed braggart and bully, too. His face is a mask of blood. Sinjir is glad that one is dead. Nearby, a young woman. He knows her face from the mess, but not her name. And the insignia rank on her chest has been covered in blood. Whoever she was, she's nobody now. Mulch for the forest. Food for the native Ewoks. Just stardust and nothing. We are all stardust and nothing, he thinks. An absurd thought, but no less absurd than the one that follows. We did this to ourselves. He should blame them. The rebels. Even now he can hear them applauding, firing blasters into the air. Hicks and yokels. Farm boy warriors and pipefitter pilots. Good for them. They deserve their celebration. Just as we deserve our graves. A pebble wakes him up. It beams off his head. A head that feels like it's been stepped on by the crushing leg of a passing Imperial walker, and lands next to his face, clattering into a small pile of other pebbles. Sinjir groans and tries to stand. The ground beneath him shifts and swings, and he feels suddenly like he's falling, even though he's not. Vertigo assails him. He blinks, tries to get his bearings. He's in a cage. Iron. Rusted. Shaped like a bird cage, except person-sized, though only barely. It dangles from a thick, heavy-gauge chain. A chain that ascends through the jagged, dripping rock above into a long, dark well. Below him is nothing. A massive rift. A black chasm between craggy, wet walls. Walls barely lit by braziers of light along a far wall. A wall that sports a narrow metal walkway bolted into the glistening rock. A figure walks along that path. A Sakian by his hairless scalp and ink-black skin. The guard has in his hand the end of a leash. The leash wound up around his wrist, all the way to the elbow. At the other end of the rope, a long, red-eyed beast. Skin is rough and ragged as the wall it passes. A narrow maw with many teeth. A sallow belly dragging along the ground.
"You're awake,"
comes a voice from behind him. Sinjir startles. It causes his own cage to swing, which in turn makes his head pound harder. He idly considers throwing up. There behind him, another half-dozen cages like his. Only two of them are occupied. In one, a skeleton. Not human, though humanoid. Something with a horn on its head. What little skin is left on those bones looks like tattered rags and strips of rotten leather. And the other... it's her! The Zabrak bounty hunter! Thankfully, it's she who spoke, not the skeleton, because... gross.
"You!" he groans. "You were throwing pebbles at me?" "Yes, me. The one you tried to buy."
Not like that. Not like you think."
"Then like how?"
He leans his forehead against the cool iron. Water drips down his head, runs down to the end of his nose. A bead of blood hangs there until he sneezes it away. A returning memory that hits him like a seismic wave.
"You really don't remember me, do you?"
"I do not."
Disappointment pulls him down like quicksand.
"I thought we shared a special moment."
"Clearly we did not."
"Endor," he says. "After everything, after the rebels secured their victory, we saw each other."
She hesitates.
"Oh, right.
So you do remember?"
"I suppose."
"Well, come now. Don't you think that's something? A moment of cosmic significance? The galaxy trying to tell us something. I mean, what are the chances?"
She sniffs.
"I don't have a droid around to tell me."
"Let's just assume astronomical, then."
"And that means what?"
I don't know. I just expect it means something."
Suddenly a pebble appears out of the half-darkness and thwacks him in the head again.
"Ow! Do you have to keep doing that? I'm awake."
"Everything means something, but not every something matters. I don't believe in cosmic significance. I don't care for magic or the Force or kissing a chit and throwing it into a fountain for good luck. I care about what I can see, taste, smell, and most important, what I can do. You mean nothing to me until you do. You're a rebel?"
He chews on his lip.
"Yes."
"Why are you here?"
I came to Surratt to find a way off this damp, jungly rock. Incidentally, did you see what happened to my friend, the tailhead?
They carried his body out after they dragged yours away.
Is he...
dead? Yes.
Sinjir shuts his eyes, says a small, meaningless prayer for the eager-eyed fool.
What was his name? Orgadomi? Or Legumo?
Orgy Borgy, whoever you are. You didn't deserve that. Why are you here? He asks. But the Zabrak ignores the question. She cranes her neck, staring out. He follows her gaze. On the walkway, the guard and the leashed creature disappear into a tunnel and are gone.
I'm planning on getting out of here,
she says.
Ah, well, good for you. Can I come?
She reaches up, fidgets with her scalp. He watches as her fingers drift along the barbed horns that form a thorny crown on her head. She grimaces as she breaks one of them off with a loud snap. He says, that looks like it hurt.
It didn't. It's fake.
She teases something out of the horn, something metal, like a key. She begins to use it on the lock at the door.
A lockpick?
Clever.
You can come with me if you're useful,
she says.
I'm very useful. A very useful rebel indeed.
The lock pops, and her door clangs open.
I'm not hearing much in evidence of that.
She jumps out of the cage backward, catching the lip of it with her hands. The whole thing swings back and forth. The Zabrak swings a few good times, then bends her back in a way that Sinjir is fairly certain would shatter his spine like a falling icicle. Her legs swing all the way up, her feet closing around the top of the cage. Her hands let go. Her legs swing her upper torso back up.
You're limber.
And you appear useless. Condolences.
She quickly climbs the chain above her cage, disappearing into the hollow space.
No, no, no! She's his one chance.
He's in this cage because he tried to save her.
Wait!
He calls.
I'm not a rebel! I'm an Imperial!
He shouts louder.
An ex-Imperial loyalty officer! I stole a rebel's clothes on Endor, and his...
But she's gone. Her cage has already stopped swinging.
Identity.
And his life. And his ship. And apparently his moral center. Well then. He groans. Again considers puking. But then, his cage shudders. And the Zabrak's upside-down face appears level with his own. She scowls.
A loyalty officer. You just became interesting and useful.
The bounty hunter holds up her lockpick.
You're going to help me catch my quarry. That's the deal. Take it, and I open this door. Leave it, and Surratt will likely sell you to the Empire. They don't care much for deserters, I hear. Once there might have been a tribunal, but these days they will shoot you in the street like a lowly cur.
I'll take the deal, as long as you help me get off this planet after.
She considers it.
Done.
As the Zabrak goes to work on the lock, she says,
I'm Jazzy Mari.
Sinjir Rathvelis.
A pleasure. If you try to frag me over, I'll gut you where you stand.
Noted.
The door pops open, and she offers a hand.
Let's go.
To Moderi, a.k.a. Tombs, pokes around the boy's junk shop. The others have gone. Once the boy himself showed up, all the digging and messing around in here stopped. Surratt said they'll get the information from the kid proper-like. Because while the kid's a punk, he's just that. He'll fold like a bad gambler and tell them how to get into the down below of this joint so they can steal back Surratt's prize and any other goodies they find. Tombs fishes in his pocket, pulls out some numb spray. He gives his bruised face a couple of good mistings.
and instantly the pain subsides underneath a carpet of sweet anesthesia.
That battle droid did a number on him.
A battle droid, of all things. Kid might be a punk, but Kid's also got talent.
Whatever. Right now, Toombs looks around the shop. Maybe he'll find something for his girl, Luda. He's on the outs with her. The same rigmarole.
You work too much, Tumata. You do not care about me. If you like Surat Nuat so much, why do you not make him your lover?
So a little prize might go a long way. But all this stuff... droid parts and conduits and pieces blown off spaceships. Over there are evaporator parts. Below them, vaporator parts. Then circuit boards in a half-rotten box. Then a box full of wonky thermal detonators. Paperweight duds.
Then he sees something. The head of a translator droid. Tarnished up, but still shiny. Luda, she likes shiny things. Maybe he could do something with it. Put a couple blood orchids in it, or hammer open the head and use it as a dish. He reaches up for it, his fingers grabbing for the eyes. The head doesn't budge off the shelf. It's bolted down.
He pulls harder,
and the eyes suddenly sink into the droid's skull with a whirr click. A door opens up. A small wind kicks up through the open space, and the Abanito sees a set of steps down. This is it. This is it. This is the way into the basement, into Temin Wexley's special stash. Toombs grabs for the comlink at his belt, but then pauses. Maybe he should go down there, take a quick look for himself. You know, for Luda. He chuckles, then steps toward the door.
Behind him, a voice.
Where is my son? A woman's voice. The Abanito purses his cracked, split lips. Then he moves fast, spinning around, reaching to draw the blaster at his side. The woman shoots first. The shot takes him in the stomach. He cries out, staggering backward as he tries to raise his own blaster. But the woman shoots again, and his weapon spins out of his hand. He clutches at his seared, smoldering middle. She steps closer to him, revealing her face under the hood. A dark-eyed, steely glare awaits. He recognizes her from the shop that day. The scowl on her face is deep. The boy's mother thrusts the pistol under his chin.
I'll ask one more time. Where is my son, Temin?
The boot presses down on the back of Temin's neck. His hands are pulled taut behind his back, swaddled in chains and held fast with a pair of magnetic manacles. He tastes blood and dust.
You stole from me,
Surat says, pressing down with his boot. Temin tries not to cry out, but it hurts, and a sound escapes his throat without him meaning. A wounded animal sound. He's here in Surat's office. It's a spare, severe room. Red walls lined with manacles. In the middle, a desk whose surface is made from some Sullustan frozen in carbonite. On that desk is a blaster, a collection of quills and a cup, a bottle of ink. The room features only one other piece of furniture. A tall black cabinet, sealed tight with a maglock.
I didn't,
Temin says.
It was an accident. I didn't know.
He's yanked up off his feet. The Herglick does the lifting. Surat stands there in front of him, pursing his lips, almost as if he wants to kiss the air. The Sullustan gangster runs an index finger under his own cheek flaps, flicking dirt away with thumb and fingertip.
You are lying to me, boy. And even if you are not lying, what does it matter? You have slighted me, and that slight must be repaid in kind.
Otherwise, how would that look?
It will look merciful.
The Celestin grabs Temin by the throat. He squeezes. The blood starts to pound in Temin's temples as he wheezes and gurgles, trying desperately to catch a breath. His whole face starts to throb.
Blackness drifts in at the edges of his vision like pools of spilled oil.
The only mercy I have ever had was a Karelian slave girl. She was nice to me. I was nice to her. Mostly.
Then the criminal overlord lets go.
Oxygen rushes back in through Temin's burning throat. He gasps and coughs, spit dangling from his lip.
The Herglick kicks him in the back of the knee, and Temin falls once more. And with his arms behind his back, the best he can do is take the hit on his shoulder so his head doesn't snap against the hard metal floor.
Let me tell you who I am,
Surratt says.
So you know what I can do. I killed my own mother for daring to speak back to me. We lived in a wind harvest tunnel on Sullust, and I threw her into the blades. When my father found out, he of course wanted to hurt me, like I hurt her. But my father, he was a soft, pliable man. He tried to hit me, and I cut his throat with a piece of kitchen cutlery. It was my brother that proved the greatest challenge. We fought for years, back and forth, from the shadows. He was ruthless. A worthy challenger, Rutar was.
The Celestin nods sagely, as if lost in memory. Suddenly he perks his head up and nods.
That's him, there.
He points to the desk.
He's the one frozen in carbonite. Some say I learned that trick from the Empire, but I assure you, they learned it from me.
Please!
Temin says, bubbles of saliva forming and popping on his lips.
Give me a chance to make it right. I can repay you. I can be in debt.
The question is, what can I take right now? An ear? A hand? My brother took my eye in our final battle.
Surratt cocks his head so that the Celestin's one milky, ruined eye is pointed right at Temin.
And that has become my way. My foes must leave, having given something vital. Not just money. Credits are so crass. But something necessary. A piece of themselves offered and taken. What do you offer?
Not that. You can take my shop. You can have my droids. I'll give you back the weapon, anything. Let's talk it out. We can talk this out, can't we?
Surratt sighs.
I think the time for talk has passed.
And then he thrusts his finger up in the air, and a big smile parts his strange face.
Ah, yes. You do love to talk, don't you? I shall take your tongue.
Temin gets his legs underneath him, tries to stand as he cries out in anger and fear. The Herglick knees him in the side and knocks him down. The slick-skinned brute laughs. Surratt says,
Gul'kula, take him to the cistern. I will get my things.
Then Surratt saunters over to his cabinet. He pulls back a sleeve and reveals a bracelet, then waves the bracelet over the maglock. It pops. As Gorkuta, the Herglick, drags Temin out of the room, kicking and screaming, Surratt removes a long surgical gown and begins to put it on, humming as he does.
This doesn't seem essential.
It is.
It's not our problem.
They're going to cut out this tongue.
Oh, now you have a soft spot. I thought you only helped those who were, how did you put it?
Useful.
The boy is useful. I believe he can furnish the repairs on my gun. Otherwise, I would leave him to his fate. Would you?
Sinjir flinches at that. Again, the questions hit him.
What kind of man am I? Am I capable of walking on past? Am I different now? Or the same?
He changed that day on Endor. Something turned inside him. The short, sharp shock of losing everything made him a new person. But to what end? Who is he now? A coward? Or someone bigger? Someone better? The two of them crouched down in the tunnels below the Alcazar, Surratt's cantina and criminal compound. After the bounty hunter hauled him up out of the dungeon he found himself in, they crept through this space looking for a way out. And there they happened upon voices in the other room. Surratt, as he abused and threatened some young kid. The shuffling of the Herglick's feet approaches. With it come the boy's grunts and bleats, plus the echoing sound of his feet kicking the floor and the walls as he struggles to escape.
You first!
Jazz hisses in Sinjir's ear. Then she shoves him out in front of the Herglick. The Herglick, a huge shiny creature, tiny eyes and a massive head. No neck, tiny teeth and a massive maw, no chin. The Herglick says. Sinjir winces, then stabs out a foot to catch the beast in the knee. A common weak point among most humanoid beings. But it's like kicking a tree. Thud! The Herglick just looks down, then snorts. The alien lets go of the boy's bound wrists and grabs Sinjir with both hands. Hands big enough to tie a speeder bike into a pretzel twist. But slippery hands, too. And Sinjir slides out of the grip and quickly goes for another weak point, the monster's throat. He flips around, trying like hell to get his arms around the creature's neck, but oops, no such neck exists. The Herglick chuckles, then jams his massive frame right, then left, each time smashing Sinjir into the wall.
Wham! Wham!
Sinjir sees stars. His brain shook up like a cocktail. A voice. Her voice. The Zabrax.
The nose,
she says. Then thrust the heel of her hand forward, smashing it right into the Herglick's nose. The alien howls, his eyes squeezing shut. Some kind of saline slime snot begins pouring out of his nasal perforations, and the poor lug slaps at his snout like it's on fire.
Get the boy, she says.
Sinjir slides around the hulking bulk of the Herglick's frame and helps the boy stand. The kid looks like some ratty street punk. Tan skin, hair up in a messy knot. Someone here has worked him over pretty good. Blooms of bruising on his cheek, a split lip.
Rescue party,
Sinjir says, offering a stiff smile. Then he shoves the boy forward, out of the range of the Herglick's meaty, blind pawing. The kid looks at the bounty hunter.
I know you,
he says.
We'll get into that,
she says.
We need to go, now.
This is her life. This is the life of a bounty hunter. It never comes easy. Many try. They pretend at doing the work, but aren't ready for what awaits. Because the job never comes easy. You think the job to extract some Quarren bookie who's been stealing from the Empire is going to be a cakewalk. And it turns out he's got 6 squid-head egg-brewed brothers and sisters who look just like him. Another job comes, and that one seems easy too. All you have to do is kill some soft-handed Black Sun accountant. But then, it turns out there's a bounty on you. And next thing you know, you're trussed up in the cargo bay of a ship belonging to that slovenly leper-head Dengar, all while your prey is hightailed into the far corners of the Outer Rim. You think, yes, I'll kill this spunky rebel princess warrior like the Empire wants. But then you watch the rebels turn the tide, and you realize the winning side isn't the winning side anymore. And if you want to survive, you damn well better change your skin or just plain disappear. You think,
I'll just take out Arson Crassus. One shot. Boom. And then you realize he's sitting there in a whole nest of Imperials. High-ranking players with big bounties. And next thing you know, you're falling. Your gun breaks, and a local gangster with delusions of grandeur forces you to bust out of his prison and out of his cantina. But when you go upstairs and plan to head right for the door, you see an Imperial officer standing there with a quartet of stormtroopers and another cadre of Surratt's thugs, not to mention the ones that will probably be coming up behind you any second. Because you just escaped their prison. And because you just released another couple of prisoners, too. The job is always complicated. It's never as easy as it seems. Even the hard ones always end up harder. But this is the life Jazz took for herself. And she's learned to handle it without panic. Or at least without letting that panic out of its cage. Fear can be a strong motivator, provided you control it rather than letting it control you. The cantina and the gambling house is full, even at this hour. Fuller now than it was earlier. A haze of smoke hovers in the air. So thick you could grab a handful and form it into a ball. The sound of the room is a low roar. A din of voices yelling, cards shuffling, knuckle dice clattering against tables. There, off to the side, a small doorway out, probably into an alley. The shame door, they call it. You get too drunk on ski? You lose your pants at a game of Kessel Wheel? You meet a new friend and don't want anybody to see you leave? You head out the shame door. Or maybe you're ushered out quietly by Surratt's men. No good to just throw those people out on the street. That tends to have a chilling effect on anybody wanting to come in through the door and spend their credits. Thing is, the shame door is always guarded. Tonight, by an Athorian with one side of his hammerhead swaddled in a bandage, the wrapping covering one eye. Jazz doesn't tell the others the plan. She just points and moves. They follow after. The Athorian grunts as he sees them come up. The alien gurgles at them in the Athorian tongue, waving them off. But then his one good eye widens. He recognizes them. In basic, he says,
"Hey!"
Jazz hooks the inside of her leg around his tree trunk limb, spins around him like he's a pole, and uses the momentum to smash the side of his head into the wall. His other eye shuts, and he topples like a felled ash sap tree. Sinjir goes to open the door, then curses under his breath.
Bug-hugging piece of starburned flog waste!
He kicks the door. At first, she doesn't see what he's going on about. But then, the door is locked. The Athorian was standing in front of the wheel lock, three colored metal plates inside a circle, like wide, flat spokes. Hit the three plates in the right combination, then spin the wheel. The door will open. Problem is, they don't have the right combination. Her planet for an astromech droid. She senses movement. Across the room, at the fore of the cantina, a stormtrooper is tapping the Imperial officer on the shoulder with one hand, and with the other, he's pointing right at them.
"We're spotted,"
she hisses. She gives a quick kick to the Athorian's hip, catching his blaster holster with the tip of her boot. The gun juggles out, and she punts it up in the air, where she catches it. Behind them, from the door they just fled, come another trio of Surratt's men.
"There!"
a thin-necked Rodian cries.
"Kill them!"
He raises his pistol, a little Blast-Tech bolt thrower, and fires. Jazz grabs Temin, pirouettes, and moves him out of the way. Just as the blaster bolt sizzles past and hits the wheel lock panel, the panel pops in a rain of sparks and hops off the wall like a framed painting during a ground quake. Jazz grits her teeth.
"Can't get out that way."
But then the door shutters and whips open, sparking. The whole system malfunctioning in their favor.
"Out!"
she says, moving the boy and the ex-Imperial out through the door and into the hammering rain. She sidesteps more incoming fire, then pivots and hops out the door. A storm rages overhead. Water runs down the crooked alley, neon light trapped in it, moving like hot pink and glow slime snakes.
The rain is coming down so hard and so fast, it's hard to see. Then the sky flashes. Blue pulses of lightning, followed swiftly by ground-shaking thunder. And it forces the eyes to readjust.
Just pick a direction,
she thinks. She takes a step one way.
There!
Comes a shout. White shapes that direction. Stormtroopers, coming around from the front side of the Alcazar. Jazz takes a few shots, then pushes Sinjir and the boy in the other direction. They bolt down the alley, feet splashing, rain threatening to push them to the cracked plastocrete and drown them like unwanted cats. The three of them turn a sharp corner. Lightning flashes again, revealing a dead end. Voices behind them. More splashing. The alley was supposed to be their way out. Now it's just a murder chute.
We're trapped, Sinjir says.
Temin shoulders into her.
My cuffs! Shoot him off!
He turns his back toward her and cranes his arms. Jazz holds one of his wrists, then puts the end of the stolen blaster against the cuffs. A red glow and rain of embers as she pulls the trigger. The bolt shrieks through the middle of the shackles, and Temin yelps, staggering forward, shaking both hands as if they're bee stung.
Come on,
he says.
Look, a storm ladder!
He points, and she follows his finger. At the end of the alley, sure enough, there's a ladder. A jointed ladder made of chains, bundled up at the top of a narrow roof. Storm ladders. Right. During bad storms, they get you off the ground quickly in case a flash flood comes churning through. A lot of rooftops have them here. The three of them hurry to the end. Temin slams up against the wall, feeling around until he finds the button. He slams it with the heel of his hand. Above his head, a clicking as the ladder is released from its mooring. A rattled clatter as it drops and smacks down against the wall. Footsteps, shouts, coming around the corner now, not even 15 meters away. A blaster bolt hisses through the rain, hits the wall. Temin begins to clamber up the ladder. But up above, a metal squeak, then a reverberating groan. The ladder above becomes suddenly unmoored, the brackets holding the chains in place popping free. Temin falls a meter, lands on his back, gasping. Jazz yells at him to move, and he does, rolling out of the way just in time as the ladder mechanism comes crashing down where his head was only a second before. Jazz helps him stand. Their one way up and out of this dead end is gone. They await no more incoming fire, because their enemies have them. What approaches is a curious mix of the Imperial and the criminal. Surratt's thugs at the edges, and the Imperials, one officer, four stormtroopers, coming down the middle. The officer is a beak-nosed prick, grinning like he gets first bite of the bird on Founder's Day.
Drop that blaster, he calls over the roar of the rain.
Jazz sucks in a breath, ponders on the way out. Shove the boy and the ex-Imperial forward, leap on their heads, use the stormtrooper helmets as stepping stones, hoping she can use the cover of night and the bad weather to escape, hoping they'll be content with their prize of Sinjir and the boy. It won't work. Too risky. She growls and lets the blaster drop into the water streaming around their feet. Lightning flashes again. And that's when she sees it.
That thing almost crushed my head,
Temin thinks, as the water gurgles past his ears. Above, storm clouds glow pregnant with lightning before discharging forked bolts across the sky. The woman, a bounty hunter, if he remembers her right, reaches down, helps him up. He's still dazed when he realizes the gig is up. Show's over. They're like droids on the sundering table, about to be ripped up for scrap. They tell Jazz to drop the blaster. She hesitates, but then does it. Temin's heart sinks. So close. Surratt will take more than his tongue for this. But then, another pulse of lightning. A smile spreads across his face. The light illuminates a figure. The figure stands on a rooftop above and behind the pack of Imperials and thugs. When the lightning flash is gone again, once more the figure merges with the darkness. But to Temin's eyes, the shape of the thing remains emblazoned upon his vision like an X-ray. He knows that skeletal shape. That beaked head, the knobby joints. Mr. Bones is here! The next lightning flash. There he is, in midair. Claw arms around his knees, spiraling through open space. Captured in the strobe-like pulse of the storm, gone again once darkness resumes. But not really gone at all. The droid lands on the ground with a hard clack and a splash. It begins. What happens next is like something out of a nightmare, Sinjir thinks, though it seems to be a nightmare dreamed up in their favor. They're standing there, about to surrender, then he sees something. Movement in the air. Something spinning. Then he hears something land. The Imperials and Surratt's men are slow to respond. Too slow, as it turns out. Two strangled cries rise up, swiftly silenced, and two stormtrooper helmets vault up into the air, turning like pinwheels. It occurs to him moments later, not the helmets, but the heads. The two other troopers turn, and so does Surratt's collection of thugs. The officer, slow to realize, is knocked to the ground as something moves into the middle of them, wading in like a threshing machine. Some shape, some bony configuration of limbs, begins wheeling about, a vibroblade buzzing through the air. Men scream. They discharge their weapons, but this thing is fast. Too fast. Improbably fast. And they end up shooting one another as the thing ducks under, its whole body bent and suddenly scuttling like a stirred-up spider. It gets underneath the officer just as he stands up.
Hey, wait, over there.
Then he's dragged down to the ground once more, thrashing about. Bones crack and shatter as the Imperial's screams are cut short. Sinjir gapes. What mad hell is this? But the boy is at his elbow, urging him on.
We have to go!
Sinjir nods gamely.
Yes. Yes, they do.
They run, past the chaos, past the throng of bodies battling a singularly insane battle droid in the rain. The droid now crowing a discordant song as he spins about, blade out, knocking stormtroopers to the ground and dispatching Surratt's thugs with a mad, dancing whirl. Temin charges hard, almost losing his balance from the water rushing around his feet. Doesn't help that he's dizzy, hungry, and shot through with so much adrenaline, he's pretty sure he might vibrate into a cloud of disconnected molecules at any given second. Ahead, a three-eyed Gron steps out, one of Surratt's many enforcers. The alien's caprine muzzle bleats out in alarm. The Gron raises a net gun, and Temin winces, waiting for the incoming blast. But there's a flash in the rain from behind the enforcer. And suddenly, the alien's three eyes roll back in their fleshy stalks before he plunges face first to the ground.
Mom!
Nora stands there, straddling a Bala Bala speeder, a narrow, stumpy vehicle meant to take the tight channels and sharp-angled turns of the streets of Mira. Everyone uses them to go to work or move crates. On any given morning or evening, the CBD ends up choked with those speeders, every one in a different color, each one modded at least a little bit by its owners. This one is blue, with a braced box rack in the back, where a chain and ball hitch are hooked as well. Temin instantly recognizes it as belonging to his aunts. Nora waves them on.
Come on! Come on!
Temin hops on the back of his speeder behind his mother. Nora starts to hit the throttle. Temin yells at her, tells her to wait for his friends. She turns, emotions warring on her face.
We have to go,
she pleads.
They saved me. They're coming or I'm not.
She gives him a nod. The other man, the tall one who came in with the bounty hunter, runs forward, ducking an incoming bolt of fire. He nearly falls over, but catches himself against the side of the speeder. Temin points him to the box rack in the back. The tall man makes a disgruntled face, but climbs into it and wads himself up like he's a too big animal for a too small crate. The man yells, "What about her?" Jazz comes up. She's got the blaster back in her hand, apparently having scooped it up. She's laying down cover and fire. The Zabrak bounty hunter turns, sees the stumpy speeder. They all look to one another in panic. The doors of the cantina burst open. More thugs and brutes. The Herglick leads the charge. Surratt is in the midst, still in his surgical robe. He points and shrieks. The bounty hunter moves fast. As she runs, she tucks the blaster in her pants. She claps her hands, yelling to the man,
"Throw me the chain!"
The tall man wings the end of the chain at her. She snatches it out of the air like it's nothing, then winds it around the dead Gron lying there. Tenon's eyes boggle. Is she doing what I think she's doing? She is. Because as soon as she has the chain around, she flinches away from incoming blaster fire and yells,
"Go, go, go!"
Nora hits the throttle. The Bala Bala lurches forward like a tauntaun with its tail stepped on. The three-eyed alien's body goes with it, at first splashing through the street water, but then skimming above it. The bounty hunter rides the body, like it's no big thing at all. Just another day in the life of Jazz Imari.
Chapter 15. In the deep well of Outer Rim space, a Carrack-class light cruiser, the Oculus, sits quiet and still amid a field of debris. The debris, the pulverized leftovers from the comet Kinro, a celestial object once predicted to carve a path clean through the core worlds many eons ago, sure to destroy one or several planets and people on them. The history books suggest that it was the Jedi who banded together, and several gave their lives, some just their minds, willing the comet to break apart before it ever even punched a hole through the mid-rim. Ensign Del Tura cares little for that history. Not because it doesn't interest him. It does. His father was a history buff. Their home had little furniture but stacks of books and heaps of maps. Right now, though, the only thing Del Tura cares about regarding this comet field is that it provides him and the cruiser perfect cover. He looks over to the young Togruta woman next to him, Science Officer Nerian. She cocks her head toward him. Nerian is cold, efficient, all business. The woman keeps her headtails pulled back behind her, bound with a small black cord. She studies him and everyone around her like they're winged insects pinned to a board. He likes that about her. Del Tura suspects it's why she's good at her job. Speaking of that, he gives her the nod.
Launch the probe droid.
She returns the nod.
Launching Viper probe droid. Designation Bulk 1.
A tap of the button, and out there, in the void of space, a plume of gas, and the droid launches. It's an Imperial droid, stolen and subverted for Alliance. He has to correct his thinking. New Republic purposes.
We good?
He asks her. She turns a dial on the console and flips a switch. The screen starts to fill up with data, and the speaker plays the strange encrypted droid song.
Already reporting in with atmospheric data.
Thank you, Officer Nerian.
He takes her hand and kisses it. She offers him a small smile. One of his greatest, most cherished things, that smile. The fact that he alone seems able to crack the ice wall facade she's thrown up gives him faith in himself, herself, them as a pair. The New Republic. Heck, the whole galaxy. Optimism blooms. He calms in. Akbar's face appears on the screen. The Admiral looks tired. Unsurprisingly. Holding together the pieces of a broken galaxy is a strain. Del Tura can only imagine the toll it has taken on the Mon Calamari.
Probe launched, Del Tura says.
Excellent, Akbar answers. See you again in 6 hours, Ensign.
6 hours. The time it will take for the probe droid to enter the space around Akiva.
though even now he can see the planet. Just a small marble floating out there beyond the debris field. She smiles.
We have time. Dinner, then rest?
Dinner, then something else,
then rest?
She chuckles. A musical sound.
The argument, raging long into the night, as turbulent as the storm outside the satrap's palace. Though the satrap seems to be the only one utterly disinterested in the storm outside, and the storm raging in this very room. He sits in the corner, slumped against the wall, snoring.
We mustn't forget that we have the credits,
Arson Crassus says, rapping his knuckles on the table as he speaks. He does this whenever he feels he's making an important point. And it would seem that he always feels he's making an important point as he makes this knock-knock-knock gesture with irritating frequency.
The credits to spend how we see fit!
Jillia Shale sits stone-faced, barely having moved in the last many hours, as if this isn't taking the toll on her that it is on the rest of them. Shale says,
Credits will not buy back our galaxy. They will not buy the hearts and minds of the people. And the Imperial coffers are far less formidable than they once were, Arson.
We still have the reserve accounts. The banking clan has wealth, tangible wealth. We can plunder yet
and plunge the galaxy into a recession?
Shale barks in a huff.
Oh, yes. That will surely win us the confidence of the people.
It's not about winning over all the people,
Crassus says.
I told you already, the best way forward is to establish a formal splinter empire. Set up a truce with these New Republic slime dogs. Allow them to go their way and we go ours. We're already locked in something of a cold war with those ninny manderers, so we make it official.
Shale rolls her eyes.
Yes, let's build a wall down the middle of the galaxy. They can have their half and we'll keep ours. It doesn't work like that. Let me make this abundantly clear to all who dare listen. We lost this war. We played with a foolish, overconfident, reckless hand, and we paid the price for it. There is no truce to be had. The New Republic will not abide us taking our toys to the Outer Rim. They will hunt us down. They will try us as war criminals. They will jail some of us and execute others.
Sloane watches as the archivist struggles to keep up, hurriedly taking notes. He and the satrap are the only others without a formal stake in the meeting allowed in the room. Even Adia must be elsewhere. Though stormtroopers guard the door, of course. Once again, Arson leans forward and starts to speak, rapping his knuckles on the table to punctuate his words.
Shale, you were a vital strategist for the Empire, and yet you lament the Empire's strategy!
Arson!
Ray blurts out.
If you bang those knuckles on this table one more time, I will break them with a stick!
Ray! That's no way to speak to me,
he blusters. Pandion smirks.
She's right, Crassus. It's deeply irritating. Do it again, and I'll break the other hand to make sure it's really, truly done.
The banker sits back, arms crossed over his barrel chest. He mopes like a scorned child.
The strategy of the Galactic Empire,
Shale begins,
was not under my supreme control. I'll make it clear yet again that I disagreed with both implementations of the Death Star. I opposed its creation from the very beginning, and in fact that opposition marginalized my input going forward, except perhaps at Hoth. But the Death Star was our undoing. That old phrase, don't work your children in the same mine, applies here. Putting so much time and money and effort and people into the ecosystem of that massive battle station was a fool's crusade. Palpatine was arrogant.
Teshu, who has been mostly quiet this entire time, frittering with his fingers and the tassels at the ends of his sleeves,
As if this is all very boring to him, or as if his mind is simply elsewhere, finally speaks up.
Velveteen's arrogance is undeniable. One also cannot deny that without it, the Empire would never have existed in the first place.
Moff Pandion, Grand Moff Pandion, apparently, stands up, begins to pace a semicircle around his end of the table.
I for once agree with Gilliar.